Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. This Friday and Saturday, Wild Bill Days in Deadwood, South Dakota. It's a celebration of the life and times of one of Deadwood's most famous gunslingers, Wild Bill Hickok. Bob Bozbell is the co-owner and publisher of True West magazine. This Friday at noon Mountain Time on the lawn of the historic Adams House, he talks about the man who created the prototype of the Western gunfighter. Bob, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Well, it's great, and I can't wait to come back up your way. I love Deadwood. I love the whole surrounding area. And last year was my first year there, and I almost predict that I'm going to make it an annual event because that's how much I love you guys.
Well, you are certainly welcome. I'm sure that affection is returned. And let's talk a little bit about the city of Deadwood and how Wild Bill figures into that. How does it all get started, this sort of legend that we deal with today in different ways?
Well, it's a perfect storm of illegality, taking land from Native Americans, the greed for gold, and it all meets in this gulch, and it is the prototype of every bad town. Now, some might say that Tombstone gives it a run for the money. Others might argue that Dodge City would give it a run for the money, but really it's Deadwood that combines all of the it was an illegal town. In fact, that's the series Deadwood. That was the David Melch's premise, is that you have this illegal town, and so they would obviously be very profane. I would take exception to some of those profanities, but that's the metaphor is perfect because you have a civilization trying to form, and as you know, power abhors a vacuum, and thugs rush in. I think that's a fair appraisal of what happened up there in your lovely town.
Thugs rush in. And so,
thugs rush in. You can quote me on that.
Wild Bill, is he a thug? Who is he?
Well, Wild Bill's a really complex character. What's amazing to me is, and I've been studying Billy the Kid, and I've been studying the Earp Brothers and Curly Bill Brocious and the whole Tombstone story. But the thing about all of them is when you look up their pictures, almost without exception, they all look like bankers. They all have on, a suit. They're posed in a kind of a Edwardian look. But with Wild Bill, I mean, that guy, you look at those pictures, every single Western movie comes from his visage, the way he looks. He's got a sash on. He's got his Colts on. A pearl handle, their butt forward. He's got great big hats that are just, you don't see them, but everybody else is wearing a derby almost, or a slouch hat. And he looked the part, and you can blame him or credit him as he set the tone for all the Westerns to come. And not only did he look the look, he walked the walk, because virtually every gunfight that you've ever seen in a Western emanates from one gunfight, and that was between Wild Bill Hickok and Dave Tutt on the square in Springfield, Missouri, July 21st, 1865. And Dave Tutt took a watch, and Wild Bill said, "Don't wear that watch at noon today on the plaza," and he did. And they shot each other at 75 yards, and Tutt missed, and Wild Bill hit him through the heart. End of that scene, and that's it. That's the prototype. Even the gunfight at the OK Corral, which is basically a misdemeanor gone awry, where one faction of thugs, the Earps, are trying to take down, are going up against the other faction who are cowboys. In a side lot, a vacant lot, and they try to arrest them, and it goes bad, and three people die. So that has become almost as famous, or more famous in some ways, than the Hickok duel. But the Hickok duel is the prototype. You can't. He created that out of his actions, and then he created it out of his looks and the way he dressed and the way he talked. And you cannot overestimate his addition to the Western, what we think of as the Western today.
How is this sort of converging with, how is that word spreading at the time? So are people writing about that scene? Is he writing about it? Is this where are we at in sort of the development of photography and printing to where this story and this really archetype that it becomes spreads?
Well, it all comes together, just as you said, photography is just coming in. So there's a lot of pictures. And in my book, I run a double truck just on Wild Bill Stylin. And he's just like, oh, my goodness, he just looks so cool. He still looks cool to this day. But every honest man secretly welcomes a press agent. And George Ward Nichols is the guy who talked to people about that fight in Springfield. And then he printed that in the, what in essence were the dime novels of the day. And so then the story spread, and the next thing you know, Hickok is the most famous man on the frontier, with the possible exception of George Armstrong Custer, Jesse James. And so he hangs out in bars and stuff, and he starts to add fuel to the stories. And he says, yeah, I killed 100 men, give or take a few. he goes along with it, and the guys, the journalists are writing this down, and so then his fame just grows bigger and bigger and bigger. And so then when Buffalo Bill goes out on his first tour, which, by the way, he lost $80,000 and went out for the second tour, which is, to me, I'll always admire Buffalo Bill for having the huevos to go out again. $80,000 in the 1860s was, he lost a couple million dollars, okay, at the very least. And he just believed in the idea of a Western show. And so he, in 1876, he hired, or went into partnership, really, with Wild Bill. But Wild Bill, and they were on tour in the East, and Wild Bill hated acting, and it was just, and he would get drunk, and he would fire blanks at the Indians' legs, who weren't Indians, they were Anglos wearing wigs. And so they were supposed to be saying their lines, and he would fire a blank and burn their leg, and so they're jumping around the stage. And he just hated it, and he left. And he wanted to go to a new place, and that new place was Deadwood.
Huh. So you mentioned alcohol a little bit, and I'm wondering, how much does alcohol kind of fuel a lot of this behavior, from the duels to the, OK Corral to sort of things gone wrong? How booze-fueled are these guys?
Well, let me put it this way. If you took alcohol out of the equation, the West, Wild West would be an awfully short chapter. There would be very little to talk about, because virtually and most 95% of the what I call classic gunfights, we feature them every month in True West magazine, and I've done 300 so far. And I would have to say that if you took the alcohol out, there'd probably be 5. It's just it's like, okay, let's put a bunch of armed guys in Sturgis. Oh wait, you do that. But anyway, let's put a bunch of armed bikers in Sturgis in a bar and give them too much alcohol. What could go wrong?
Seems
with that?
Like a good idea. Hey, let's do it every year.
Yeah.
Does Custer pattern his look after Wild Bill? I mean, how much is because Custer?
No, that is a great question. Now, when I was growing up in the '60s, there were historians who said that intimated that Wild Bill was homosexual. Because I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but in the '60s, long hair was just about that. If you went into a bar with long hair in a country bar, you better be ready to put your fists up, okay? Because it was fighting, and we just come out of World War II, where everybody was a shaved tail, everybody had their head shaved, and so Manly had become short hair, and so when we looked at the picture of Custer and Wild Bill and the Mountain Men, we thought, people of that time, the 1960s, thought, oh, these guys must be gay, they're female, and the same thing happened when the Beatles hit here, and, I remember the reporters in New York asking the Beatles, how can you sleep with all that hair? And I think it was Ringo said, how do you sleep with arms and legs? I mean, it's just such a, if you think today is dumb, it was even dumber in the 60s. But anyway, the scouts, the mountain men, and Custer and Wild Bill, the word on the plains was you wore your hair long, daring your enemies, the Native Americans, to come scalp you. That was it. If you had short hair, you were a coward. Huh. Isn't that amazing?
I've never heard that before.
That's why they sported the long hair. It was almost like a rooster to say, "Hey, come and get it, dude. You think you can take this? Take me and take my hair. Come and get it."
Yeah, how'd that work for Custer?
Well, it didn't work out well for either one of them, and that, which probably says a lot about male toxicity, more than I would like to admit. And the tragedy, of course, with Wild Bill is that, to go back to the Beatles, this is John Lennon being assassinated for being famous. Moths to a flame and being successful, as Henry Kissinger said, just gives you a ticket to a bigger problem. And being famous draws crazy people to you. And it's just the sad ending to that story. Every time I want it to end differently, and every time it doesn't. Mm.
Tell us, for those who don't know the legend well, he doesn't die like he would want to. How does his death unfold?
Well, he just got married, and of course, in the legend, he's wedded to Calamity Jane, and that's really just part of the legend. Bill had just gotten married to Agnes Lake, who's a circus performer, and I think that says a lot about Wild Bill, is that he needed somebody who knew that orbit that was being created in America, where there was a celebrity class of which Buffalo Bill became the – Buffalo Bill was the first international superstar, you know.
Right.
He was our Beatles going to Europe. And so Wild Bill married a circus performer, Agnes Lake, and she didn't leave behind very attractive pictures. A lot of my friends look at her and go, gee, Wild Bill couldn't do better than that. You know, there's the real sexist kind of thing going there. But anyway, so he was in Cheyenne. He was threatened with being arrested for vagrancy, and it basically the town fathers just didn't want him there because he represented a changing, you know, a lawlessness that they wanted to put in the past. And so Wild Bill and Charlie Utter go to on a wagon train, and they go to Deadwood, and they're like the first ones there, and they have a camp just outside of town, and Wild Bill goes in. He's trying to – he sends wonderful, lovely letters to his wife and says, I hope I can make my strike here and we'll be able to retire, et cetera. And, of course, he's in the number 10 saloon, and he legend says he normally always put his back to the door, and that place was taken. The guy wouldn't take it, and so he sits down, and Jack McCall, this ne'er-do-well, comes in and shoots him in the back of the head. And, you know, in the movies, there's this, like, a you know, explosion, and of course, in his hand is the dead man's hand. Well, in real life, the bullet went through his back of his head and hit the guy sitting in front of him in the wrist. And he thought Wild Bill had shot him. Hmm. That's how confusing it was in the saloon. And of course, all the cards dropped to the floor, and legend says someone picked them up, and it was aces and eights, which forevermore has been known as the dead man's hand. But there's really not much proof that really happened. But that's how legends get started, and that's it's just so incredible to me that something that minute would be that big. I mean, you just ask anybody that's ever played cards, what's the dead man's hand, and they know aces and eights. And it's become universal around the world. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Huh. So let's talk a little bit about that, because as we've had this conversation, we've talked about, you know, thug behavior and illegality, and then we've had some good laughs and the legends that are true and that are not. And I'm wondering why they're important. Why, you know, why are these stories still around, and what's our role? You know, what's your role as an author and historian to sort of preserve them in a way that's responsible, that's accurate, And it looks at the whole picture of who these people were. We mentioned, you know, greed and land grabbing and taunting and Native Americans. And there's a lot going on in these stories. Well, why do they matter today?
Well, you know, there's I read an interview with Don Hewitt, who developed 60 Minutes, and which is one of the longest running television shows in history. And they said, "What's your secret, Don?" And he said, four words: tell me a story. Mm-hmm. And we are just drawn to good storytelling. And in the development of this, the Western story, second of all, a story needs conflict. It's a conflict is oxygen to a story. That's why people write books, and I've seen them in your area, where people are going, "I'm going to write a story about my Uncle Bill or my dad. He was such a good man, and I'm going to write this book, and it's going to be so good to tell the truth." And then they can't say anything bad about their dad or their uncle, and so these books are just like, you put you to sleep. They even try to read 10 pages because there's no conflict. They don't want to say anything bad about their relatives.
Right.
And in fact, I have a model, and that is, people will say to me, "Hey, you know, I talked to Pat Garrett's family, and they said he wasn't there that night." And I go, "You know what? Nobody knows less than the family." Because what father's going to sit their son down and go, "You know, I was drunk on my butt, and I was out with these prostitutes, and this gunfight ensued, and I shot this guy in the belly, and I served time." And no dad's going to say that. You'd be reported to the dad delinquency program. You know, you'd be put in jail for being a bad dad.
There's
so,
no Father's Day card for stories, that, yeah.
Yeah, those stories are always just awful. And why? Because there's no conflict. So, yeah. Number one, Americans or we Southwesterners, but we on this planet are attracted to conflict, which is why Game of Thrones was so successful. Nobody in my memory has done conflict better than George R. R. Martin. He can open up a scene, and two people are in a life and death situation talking to each other, and a third person comes in. And if the scale of 1 to 10 on conflict, and 10 being the most conflicted, they go from a 9 to a 10, and you're sitting there going, "Oh, I don't know where this is going." Well, that's why that show was so phenomenal, and that's why the Western stories worked for a long time. They don't work as well now because of the Native American thing, and that all changed in the 1960s with a couple books. One was "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee." And America woke up the next day and said, "You know, I don't feel comfortable with shooting Indians." Or there's actors in Hollywood to this day who will not read a script if they have to shoot a Native American. So once you do that, once you get to there, which is where we are, you just lost half your protagonist or your antagonist. You can't the attack on the wagon train doesn't work because the audience is rooting for the Indians to go, you know, get those immigrants out of here, you know? They should have built the wall.
The book is called The Illustrated Life and Times of Wild Bill Hickok. You can see our guest, Bob Bose Bell. He's the publisher and editor of True West Magazine and the author of that book. Friday, June 14th at the historic Adams House. Bring your lunch, and he'll sign books from 2 to 5. The presentation is at noon, Mountain Time. Bob, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
You know, let me make one more claim, and I absolutely guarantee this, that if you come to this event on Friday and buy my book and I sign it, I absolutely guarantee with my signature that someday it'll be worth the cover price.
Thanks so much, Bob. Appreciate it.
All right, man. Thank you.